from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The U.S. Supreme Court has blocked the Trump administration from adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census for now. It also decided that federal courts would not intervene in claims of partisan gerrymandering in Maryland and North Carolina. We look at the impacts of these decisions in this half hour of Forum with David Levine. He's a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. Good morning, David Levine.
Good morning, Mina.
So let's start with the census decision. The court says that Secretary Wilbur Ross's decision to reinstate the citizen question was reasonable and reasonably explained, but it also remanded the decision back to the lower court, saying that it cannot be adequately explained in terms of the Department of Justice's request for improved citizenship data to better enforce the Voting Rights Act. So what does that mean for a citizenship question on the 2020 census?
Okay. Well, the opinion is extremely complicated.
Yes.
We've only begun to scratch the surface of it this morning. The bottom line is that it's really hard to imagine that the citizenship question will be on the census this time. And the reason why is that the whole reason that the Supreme Court actually rushed into this was that the government said that they had to be ready to go June 30th, that that was the do-or-die date, because a billion pieces of paper need to be printed to start working on the census in January. So that was the government's claim. The U.S. Supreme Court accepted that. They jumped the case from the district court. And so it's rather difficult to imagine that all of a sudden the work that needs to be done to justify the opinion to satisfy the new opinion from Chief Justice Roberts could be done. It's just impossible to imagine that actually would happen.
So you're saying, no, you think there is no chance that there's going to be a citizenship question on the 2020 census?
Extremely unlikely, simply because of the time involved. Just for that alone, it's really hard to imagine, because what the Supreme Court did is they said, hey, District Court, you have to send it back to the Census Bureau. They have to justify this properly. And so that would take time to create that record. So after all, here we are, we're nearly at the end of June. January 1 is coming in 6 months, no matter what. So unless somehow there's a way to print these things on a much faster schedule, it's really hard to imagine. So is it impossible? Maybe not. Is it extremely unlikely? I think certainly we can say that.
I see. The only reason I ask is because June 30th was sort of a self-imposed date.
Right.
And so maybe they could say, hey, you know what? We found, 2 months in there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's some suggestion that they could go to the end of October and still get it done. But I guess by hiring, we won't give it free advertising to all the private companies, copy companies. But I suppose if you engage every private copier around every university around the United States, you could get everything printed. But nevertheless, extremely, extremely unlikely because of the need to create this record, because the reason, the core, I would say the most important word in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion is the word contrived.
Yes.
That he said that the justification was contrived. And what we know about that is that that is quite true, that the Commerce Department went fishing for a reason to justify the citizenship question. The Justice Department was willing to say, okay, we'll ask you for the data to enforce the Voting Rights Act. And of course, the Trump administration is famous for zealously enforcing the Voting Rights Act. So that it was always suspicious.
Yes. And then on the other side of that, there was also this discovery of hard drives from a Republican operative.
That's right.
That included a study that basically, if you redrew legislative districts based on citizenship data, based on citizens, voting citizens, that you would be able to give Republicans a very big advantage and to disadvantage Hispanics. I know that the decision did not reference this, but do you think it was operating in the background for these justices?
It may well have been, because the Supreme Court has been peppered with letters and motions and requests all week long about this. Indeed, earlier in the week, the Fourth Circuit opened the door for the complementary case in Maryland to reexamine this evidence. So this evidence is going to come in without a doubt. So it might have been part of it, but it is true they didn't reference it because they said it was not part of the record in front of the district court in New York. What we do know about this, and it was this accident that it was found. This man, Thomas Heffler, died in August, and he's a Republican redistricting strategist. The New York Times called him the Michelangelo of gerrymandering. And he is the one who devised this idea. He, in fact, it looks like he ghost wrote the letter that the Department of Justice sent to the Census Bureau making this request, or to the Commerce Secretary making this request. So all of that information is going to come out one way or the other, whether it's in the New York case or the Maryland case. So given that the existing justification was deemed contrived by five justices of the Supreme Court without worrying about all this other information, it's really hard to imagine how this contrived request and worse is somehow going to be turned into a proper answer, all in time to get those documents printed.
How surprised are you by the Supreme Court decision?
Reasonably surprised. What I thought was that, to be honest, what I thought would happen is that the five justices, Chief Justice Roberts and the other conservatives, would say the stated reason is good enough. That's what the four more conservative justices said, is that, look, this is something that has been on the census from 1820 until 1950. And then in part, people were asked every year, every census, and then it was only stopped in 2010. So there's this long history. Four justices said, if there is a reason, basically, we're not going to second guess it. Just because there might have been other reasons, it is not for us to second guess it. Something like the travel ban cases. We're going to defer to the administration. I thought that, to be honest, I thought that Chief Justice Roberts would go along with that. This opinion has this split quality, much like his opinion in the Affordable Care Act case. He's splitting things up in such a way that he did come to a somewhat surprising result. It's utterly justifiable. I think it is the right result. But if we had been talking yesterday, what do you think is going to happen? I would have thought 5-4 the other way, to be honest.
Well, let me invite our listeners to share their opinions of this decision on the census question. You can join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, on Facebook, on Twitter, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Jake writes, the language in the Constitution about the census makes it clear that its purpose is to count all people in the country, not just its citizens. Government services are supposed to serve both citizens and non-citizens, who for the most part are productive members of the economy and society. Virgil writes, I strongly suspect the opponents of the citizenship question just don't want an accurate count of the number of USA citizens. David Levine, just remind us more broadly of the electoral consequences, you know, representation as well as federal funding that comes with the census and the issues that come with an inaccurate count.
Sure. The stakes for this were always and are enormous. Number one, the census is used every 10 years to determine how many members of the House of Representatives go to each state. So in the 2010 census, for example, Texas and Florida were lucky enough to pick up four representatives each. New York and Ohio lost two. We were looking at, we may still be looking at the loss of one, and I think it was possible that we would lose two representatives. So how many representatives do you get in Congress? That translates into Electoral College votes. As you may remember, in the last election, it was the Electoral College that elected President Trump. It wasn't the popular vote. Number three, money is allocated according to formulas based on how many people are counted on this. The number I have from 2016 is that $900 billion was distributed to states according to the 2010 census formulas a year. So if you lose 2, 3, 5% of your money because of an undercount, that is a huge amount of money, and that would be true locked in for 10 years. And then I guess the last is to the extent to which this same information is used to redistrict in states for their state legislatures. Again, it's an issue. How many people are in one district versus another? So the stakes are just huge for politics.
So before we talk about the gerrymandering decision, I just want to ask you how this citizenship question could play out. So could there just be a better explanation given to the courts, regardless of this whole question of discriminatory intent, that would then allow this process to move forward?
Theoretically, yes. The problem is there doesn't seem to be anything. The problem is that the Census Bureau experts all said, don't do this. They told Secretary Ross, our current Commerce Secretary, don't do this. There is going to be an undercount. Now, what the Supreme Court opinion says is, well, the Secretary weighed different things, and he thought that the benefits of getting the information, especially in light of the Justice Department, were worth it. But you still have this problem that this whole reasoning is contrived. So you're going to have to come up with something else and work against the fact that your stated reason was contrived. Well, what are they going to discover in a short period of time? And the real push is because this happens only every 10 years.
Well, let me bring Ram into the conversation. Hi, Ram.
Hi, Meena. Thanks for calling. Thanks for taking my call. So I have a basic comment. The comment is, it's a fundamental right. It's a strong fundamental right for any government in any country to know who are the citizens, who are not. So Supreme Court cannot deny this fundamental right. And if they do, it will be really unconstitutional and it will be really unfortunate. It's an absolutely strong fundamental right of any government in any country to know who are the citizens.
Ram, thanks. And the Supreme Court ultimately agree that it is. It's just saying it can't do it under certain circumstances.
Right, right. This is very much an opinion under the Administrative Procedure Act. Now, law school professors get all excited about the Administrative Procedure Act, and a lot of lawyers do. For our purposes, I won't go into all the detail on it. But it's the Secretary Ross could have reached this decision legitimately, but he can't get there illegitimately. And the question with respect to the caller, an excellent, excellent question. Nobody's questioning that that it wouldn't be appropriate to get information about citizens, certainly statistical data about citizens. But what the Census Bureau said is we can obtain statistically significant results without hurting the census process. The census process is to enumerate every person. That's what the Constitution says. Every person, not every citizen. And anything but that count is all for data collection purposes. So the data can be collected in some other way. So the caller is right in that sense. Chief Justice Roberts, and I think 9 justices of the Supreme Court would agree with him, as do I. It's a matter of means.
Well, let's move on to the gerrymandering case. So the court in this case holds that partisan gerrymandering claims present political questions beyond the reach of the federal courts.
Right. That's quite right. By 5-4 decision, again, Chief Justice Roberts, this time voting completely with the conservative colleagues in this 5-4 opinion, said this is something that the courts need to stay out of. It's a well-understood doctrine. The political question doctrine is the idea that there's no role for the courts to play in certain issues, that these are things that are left to politics. They are left to the executive branch. They are left to the legislative branch. And as the Chief Justice pointed out, in this case, also left to states to have some role, state legislatures, ballot propositions such as we have here in California. So the Supreme Court majority, 5-4, said we just have no role to play here.
Yes, and just to review, in North Carolina, they were alleging gerrymandering by Republicans. In Maryland, it was by Democrats. So, okay, you say certain cases. When is partisan gerrymandering not okay? What was the Supreme Court saying around that?
It's not for us to say, is what they were saying. It is not for the Supreme Court to say, any court, any federal court, to say there is too much partisan gerrymandering, that it's simply something left to politics. Now, other kind of gerrymandering, that's another matter.
Right, related
racial,
to equal protection.
Racial gerrymandering is still something that courts can get involved in. And what we would expect is going to happen is that people who want to challenge redistricting lines are going to say, oh, these are really racially motivated, and On the flip side, they're going to say, no, this is political gerrymandering. It has nothing to do with race, even though there's, in certain ways, there's a high correlation between the two, in that as the Republican Party is getting whiter and whiter and the Democratic Party is having more and more higher percentage of minorities in the organization, the two come together. So there's going to be a high correlation. So how are you going to separate out partisan gerrymandering, for which federal courts have no role, versus racial gerrymandering, for which federal courts will continue to have at least a limited role? The other thing I might add here is that I'll anticipate a question. What difference does it make that Justice Kavanaugh is there? What difference does it make that Justice Gorsuch is there? And the answer is, in this case, a huge difference.
Yes.
Because these cases at the lower court level were designed to entice a vote from Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy had always been the swing vote in this area,
yes,
where he was searching for a way to put limits on partisan gerrymandering. And these cases presented ways to do that. And it clearly was set up to have Justice Kennedy sitting there today or when the case was argued. But by the time the cases got to the Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy, of course, had decided to retire and Justice Kavanaugh took his place. And here is a perfect example where that kind of decision has made a huge difference.
You did anticipate my question, because my reaction was, wow, Kavanaugh was decisive.
Absolutely.
In this verdict.
And Gorsuch, too. Imagine if Merrick Garland had been there, if it had been Garland and Gorsuch instead of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Huge difference.
I was really struck by Justice Elena Kagan's dissent. It was quite strongly worded. She began with, "For the first time ever, this court refuses to remedy a constitutional violation because it thinks the task beyond judicial capabilities." And she goes on to say that partisan gerrymanders here debased and dishonored our democracy.
Right. And she also says, "And the majority doesn't disagree with me on that." Everybody knows that's what's going on. It's a question of who can step in. Justice Kagan is one who has always been concerned about shoring up the political process so that it is fair. And here is a case where she sees that this is just going to go off the rails without some role for the Supreme Court. Yeah, she has very strong language in the opinion. She ends it in a way I've never seen before. She says her last line is, "With respect, but deep sadness,
yes,
I dissent." That's something I think we'll long remember because of this. This is such an important case. Now, if the census case had gone the other way, it would have been partisan gerrymandering on steroids. Now we only have partisan gerrymandering on, let's say, over-the-counter products, not on prescription steroids.
So then could we see a more intense push for independent commissions like the one we have in California?
Yes, the remedy is, number one remedy, I think, would be for states to decide we don't want to have partisan gerrymandering. Now, the problem is that state legislatures love partisan gerrymandering so long as it protects incumbents. And so how do you get around that? Well, in a place like California, we did with the ballot proposition. And there's other states that could do that. The states that have a robust ballot proposition system theoretically could do that. Theoretically, Congress could step in. Not very likely, given how well Congress is getting along with one another these days, but that's a theoretical possibility. And Roberts talks about that. He says, look, it's not that there's no remedy. It's not that this isn't a problem. It's just you've come to the wrong place in the government to try and solve the problem. So good luck to you, but we'll see you. We'll see you again.
And again, David Levine is professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. And let's go to listeners. Mark in San Jose. Go ahead.
The last comment by Professor Levine is a perfect segue. You've come to the wrong court. Boy, this seems to fly in the face of Marbury versus Madison. That's your job. Judicial review of a fundamental democratic and constitutional tenet that underlies the entire game that we tried to create. How did we get to this point? That's my question.
Yeah, Justice Elena Kagan certainly agrees with you, Mark.
Right. How did we get to this point? Two words, Mitch McConnell.
Well, speaking of Mitch McConnell, it was interesting how flat, actually, in last night's Democratic debate, the responses were to that. Because arguably, yes, he is a threat.
Right, right. And they had no real answer to that, because unless the Senate flips to a Democratic majority, then the majority leader has so much power the way the Senate is set up, there's really very little you can do. You can try and work with the person. I'm sure tonight Joe Biden is going to say, I'm the guy who can do that. The reality is we have to work across the aisle. I've been a senator. I know how to do it. Let me have a chance. That's what he'll say. Other people will say different things, but that's what I'm sure he'll say.
Well, Mike writes, I'm happy about the census decision, but it just proves the point that SCOTUS is ultimately a political body, with Roberts changing horses based on reading political tea leaves as much as a judicial one, and it's time to rethink lifetime appointments. Richard writes, on the matter of whether the citizenship question will appear on the 2020 census, don't assume that the Trump administration will take this so easily. They will find another angle.
Never underestimate them, let's say. But it's hard to see how that's going to happen. We have two live district court cases going. So there's federal supervision over what the Census Bureau now proposes to do. So it is, I mean, I can't say absolutely positively it's not going to happen, but it seems extremely unlikely. Again, maybe we should take a moment about how the census works to remind everybody, since it's been 10 years since we've gone through this. The paper census forms go out to everybody. And if you don't return them, then census workers will come and try to find you. The idea, the partisan idea behind this, the nefarious idea behind this, is simply putting the citizenship question on the questionnaire would deter undocumented people or people who have undocumented members of their family from even returning the forms for fear that that information would be used against them. Now, when people from the government come knocking on the doors of those same people, how eager are they going to be to then answer the question? So we're going to end up with an undercount. That's the two-part step that the people were fearing from what the Census Bureau was proposing to do, or the Commerce Department.
Well, Steve writes, I'm shocked that the conservatives on the Supreme Court could not find constitutional grounds to strike down partisan gerrymandering. A very sad day for all who believe in fairness in our democracy. I mean, this whole point about it being a political question that the judicial body does not weigh in on. I mean, ultimately, then who does if there's political abuse? Who does when things are being determined politically rather than in terms of what's best or what's fair under the law?
Right. Well, there are some remedies. One could be state court. So, for example, in Pennsylvania, there was redistricting done by the court in Pennsylvania completely based on state law. So that's always a possibility as well, that a state court, state Supreme Court, could interpret its own equal protection clause to require limits on state gerrymandering.
So today's decision won't have bearing on
Pennsylvania? No, not under state constitutions, not at all. No, it's only a matter of, can you use the federal constitution to do this? The other thing that Chief Justice Roberts pointed out is there's a number of ways to think about what fairness requires, and that because it's hard to figure out what is the right version of fairness, that helped impel him to say this ought to be a political question. It ought to be worked out the way he frames it is the way the founders intended, which is they made it a political question, and we, the Supreme Court, should not second guess that. So it's a form of saying, we're very democratic. We're saying that the most democratic branches ought to be making these decisions, or the people themselves, not even the quote, capital R Republican version of the way the democracy works is that you elect representatives, but even direct democracy would be there. Now, the four in dissent very, very, very strongly said, no, it's not going to work that way, and that we are abdicating our responsibilities. Now, the last thing I'll say about it is that these positions were kind of hardened in a long time ago. We've had this 4-1-4 with Kennedy there for quite some time. So it's clearly been a close choice at the Supreme Court. It's just the replacement of one justice for another that we now have a definitive choice.
Well, and so let's stay on that point. I mean, you gave the example of Kavanaugh's influence showing up in the gerrymandering decision. Are you noticing a more substantive balance of power shift now that we do have these five solid Republicans? Did you notice it in this past year, or do you think we'll see more of it in the next term?
Well, I'll tell you, there's cases coming up in the fall where I think it's going to be very clear, likely to be very, very clear. There are three cases, Title VII work discrimination cases. One, and I think related to what you're going to be doing next hour, one has to do with whether transgender people are protected under Title VII and whether sexual orientation is protected under Title VII. Well, Justice Kennedy, the person who wrote Obergefell, the person who brought us same-sex marriage, is gone. And you would have thought that we'll see how it plays out, but he presumably would have been much more open to the arguments that Title VII does protect those classes of people in a way that the newer justices may not. We don't know yet for sure. The other thing I'll say is that one of the things that we're starting to see is some interesting splits between Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on a couple of decisions where they're turning into slightly different conservatives. They are absolutely conservative. They're very, very conservative, but just slight differences. So there was an opinion, there was a statutory opinion that Gorsuch wrote earlier this week, and Kavanaugh was in dissent, and Gorsuch joined the liberals to come up with a result involving an interpretation of criminal law. So we may see more of those as we go along.
The other case I'm interested in is the one that's related to the Affordable Care Act and this question of whether or not the federal government could break its promise to insurance companies when— Yes. —it said it would pay them for some of the losses they would experience with the changes that came with the Affordable Care Act. Well, which way do you think that will go? I know
yeah.
it's hard to predict these kinds of things, but
the Supreme Court took the case.
They did.
You need four justices to accept a case, and if you're shrewd about it, you're not going to vote to be one of the justices to accept a case unless you think the fifth vote is there somewhere. This one is tricky because even if for the justices who don't like the Affordable Care Act, still to say, well, Congress can break a promise that it made as part of that package, I think it's maybe harder for them to say that's okay. They might still say we're holding our noses with respect to the Affordable Care Act, but this one might go in favor of the insurers rather than against them.
And this listener writes, I don't understand the concern. This is related to the citizenship question. For discriminatory intent, didn't we have that in the new tax law, in redistributing and gerrymandering and college acceptances? Some people win and some people lose. That's life. Manisha asks, if the citizenship question makes its way, would individuals have to provide proof of citizenship if they say yes when someone comes knocking on their door for them to complete the survey? Will they be required to show proof of legal status if they say no?
No. I think the short is no.
But Manisha's question is basically what the advocates, especially for immigrants, are talking about. Are the concerns.
Sure.
There's also concerns about a disinformation campaign. My understanding is that tech companies are being brought in to try to deal with any disinformation that comes from.
Right. There's going to be that enormous effort. California is spending a lot of money to try and counter some of that. So we'll see how it plays out.
David Levine of UC Hastings College of the Law, thanks for talking with us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
KQED Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineers are Katie McMurrin, Jim Bennett, and Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with support from Amanda Font and Ariana Prale. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Our executive editor is Ethan Lindsay. And our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Another Hour Forum is next. I'm Nina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.